Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, unless we specifically ask for calls, because we have this evening from Jackson, Mississippi, Dr. Russell Blaylock. And Dr. Blaylock worked for many, many years as a neurosurgeon, has written a number of books which we carry, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life, Natural Strategies for Cancer Patients, the excitotoxins, the taste that kills. He actually has a newsletter that's circulated by Newsmax, and I take that newsletter too. Fascinating amount of information there about medicine and the things you really need to know to keep you healthy. But this evening, we're going to start out talking about, I think, what's on everybody's mind, and that is the hurricane. Fortunately, it's down to a class 3 hurricane that just hit or is about to hit Texas and will probably be on shore early in the morning. And certainly, in lieu of what happened just 2 weeks ago in the New Orleans area, and Dr. Blaylock had a son who lived there. He's very, very close to the situation there, living in Mississippi, which was, of course, along the coast, was totally devastated. So anyway, without further ado, Russell, how are you tonight?
Fine, Stan. How are you today?
I'm doing fine. Well, what's your take on this situation, the fact that the people, of course, were asked to leave New Orleans, and then, of course, they started told to come back, and they started to come back, and then they're told to leave again, and, you know, there must be an awful lot of chaos there.
Well, there is, and I think this is an excellent demonstration of the failure of government officials. New Orleans is notorious for its corruption. It's just one of the most corrupt city administrations, certainly a string of mayors over the years have literally stolen the city blind, and we've had all sorts of corruption and scandals with the police department, and all of this came to fore during this terrible disaster. And it's a good parallel or example between what happened on the Gulf Coast in Mississippi, what we saw in the state of Louisiana. The crisis for Mississippi was handled much, much better. The governor carried out the evacuation and the transport of the military troops and bringing aid to these people much, much better. What we saw in Louisiana was a governor that was incompetent. We saw a mayor that continues to show his incompetence. And, you know, he's responsible for a lot of the deaths in that city. And I think that's obvious to even the casual observer, that this man sat, at the helm, of that city, allowed these people to drown, to die of sickness, to allow a significant amount to be shot to death, allowed the destruction of, all the major hospitals in New Orleans. The place is just devastated. I mean, I don't think that the average public realizes the extent of the damage in the city of New Orleans, and I really don't see how anyone could go back there and expect to remain safe. It's just an unsafe city at this point.
I think one of the interesting things was that the mayor was asked why he didn't use the school buses or other buses to, you know, to evacuate the 100,000 people who were there, some of whom did want to leave but didn't have a means of transportation. We said he just couldn't find anybody to drive the buses, and but he just got a few people to drive the buses to take the people to the Superdome, where they just dropped them off and left them there. You know, you would think that maybe he could have got the people from the National Guard to drive the buses. I mean, a few of those must have known how to drive a car and a bus.
Well, the National Guard wasn't even allowed into the city, right, for 6 days. But what they had is plenty of people who were the victims who said, well, we'd been glad to drive the buses. So there wasn't any shortage. In fact, they even had a 16-year-old kid who drove one of the buses all the way to Houston, Texas.
And I think what was interesting, the mayor seemed to be much more interested in getting out of town himself and setting up his administration in another city that was safe.
Right. He was in Baton Rouge immediately, and he stayed in Baton Rouge in a plush hotel, watched the whole thing. The 2,000 buses that he did not use to evacuate these people ended up under 6 to 8 feet of water. And so then they were totally worthless. Now, he had people crowded in the Superdome. Had no security in the Superdome. We had multiple rapes, multiple murders. They found 17 dead bodies in the bathroom when they later evacuated it 6 days later. And the other facility, they had 12 dead bodies. They had them in the building itself. They had them outside on the sidewalk, dying, bloated bodies in the sun. The place was smeared in feces. They destroyed the building. There were shootings, murders, rapes. Even the bodies were mutilated after death. In fact, they showed it on the national news. People that were in wheelchairs were murdered and their bodies mutilated. And, of course, they said it was too horrible to show. For a while, there were all these shootings in the city during the peak of this crisis. And the national media put out the story and then all the denials saying, oh, these were cars backfiring and of course, there were no cars. It was underwater. No one was driving around with a car backfiring. And then the videos come out, and they show the police hunkering down, shots being fired, fully automatic. The gangs were running rampant. They were taking over the hospital, stealing all the drugs. The doctors had to hide behind barricades to protect themselves and their patients. The doctors and the nurses were left abandoned by the rescue personnel in Charity Hospital and the other hospitals. In fact, they found, 45 bodies in one of the big hospitals, the Baptist Hospital there in New Orleans. And this was where my grandson was born. He's 8 months old. He was born in that hospital. It's a beautiful hospital.
It was a beautiful hospital.
He was totally devastated when they went into the hospital. There was not a soul there. There were 45 dead bodies. Some of them still in the bed, some of them on the floor. And the doctors who escaped said, well, we were abandoned for 6 days. It was 110 degrees.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. Russell Blaylock. And he's describing really what happened in New Orleans. The mayor, who, of course, has gotten a lot of play in the media, heroic mayor, criticizing the president and the governor for not doing anything. It was his responsibility, of course, to follow the plan. There was a master plan. They had plenty of buses. He just didn't. His excuse was, well, I couldn't find anybody to drive the buses. Well, first of all, it was on the 26th that they announced that the hurricane was going to hit the town. That was on Friday. And at that time, of course, they declared a state of emergency, but nothing happened. They told the people to leave town. 400,000 people picked up and left town. Now, they're homes are there, they're unguarded. Why weren't the National Guard called in to guard those homes? Because actually gangs of thugs came in from other cities. Two or three other cities, thugs came in from to engage in the looting. But you see, there weren't any National Guard, and the police there, pretty corrupt anyway. So the homes were left there, completely unguarded. Would you want to leave your home unguarded, when there's going to be looting? Of course you wouldn't. So why wasn't the National Guard there? They were not brought in. And of course, Dr. Blaylock has pointed out, there were about 2,000 buses, and instead of using them to evacuate the people who wanted to leave and had no means of transportation, why, they were left to be flooded. And the excuse the governor gave was, he couldn't find anybody to drive the buses. There are lots of people who could drive the buses. Why not have the National Guard? Well, the National Guard wasn't there. They were not brought in. How could you do such a poor job unintentionally when there was a master plan and the mayor just refused to follow the master plan? The governor refused to follow the master plan. Pick up the story there, Russell.
Well, and, at the beginning of this, they had 6,000 to 7,000 Louisiana National Guard sitting in Baton Rouge outside of New Orleans, and the governor had no idea what to do. So she sat there with the National Guard waiting for orders from her, because she has to give the order for them to enter the city, for 6 days. It's just boiling heat in New Orleans. The humidity is over 100%. They're sitting in this cesspool because all the sewers had ruptured into the water. It was full of chemicals. I've gotten reports now from police officers in New Orleans that the people's legs were burned from walking in the water because the chemicals were of such high concentration. They had weeping ulcers and sores in their legs from contact with this water. Now, for 7 days, 6 days, these people were left in that with no water, no food, boiling in the sun, babies dying, children dying, old people dying in their wheelchairs, and she continued to sit on these troops. And then finally, after 6 days, someone shook her and woke her up and said, "You need to get these National Guardsmen in." And well, by then, there were 10 to 15,000 National Guardsmen. When they brought the National Guard in, of course, order was regained. The gangs disappeared. They had looted the town. They burned the houses. They burned the department stores to the ground after they looted them. They had 400 policemen who just walked off the job. But not only did they walk off the job, but they looted the town before they left. Now, this is an absolute scandal that the police department has 400 coward policemen who leave and then loot the town before they leave, just like common criminals. All of this is because of the administration of this city. It's due to Mayor Nagin. He is a completely irresponsible mayor of the city, and he's responsible for this disaster that happened within that 6 days. Now, not only that, then we have FEMA come in. They come into Jefferson Parish, which is to the west of New Orleans. It's contiguous with it. In Jefferson Parish, and Walmart brought in a truckload, a semi full of water, and another vehicles brought in diesel fuel. FEMA stopped them and told them, "Turn back, we don't need it in New Orleans." Now, this is during the 6 days that people were dying for lack of water and food. FEMA turned them back, and then they cut the lines of communication to New Orleans. Now, Sheriff Harry Lee, who's the sheriff of Jefferson Parish, he was so incensed, he came in with his deputies and told them, reconnect those lines of communication, and he put armed guards around it to keep the FEMA people away.
Now, my understanding was that the rationale was they wanted no communication so the people would be forced to leave. Was that it? What was the rationale?
They gave no rationale. This is the thing. They had no rationale for turning back the water, no rationale for turning back the diesel fuel or cutting the communication lines. They just did it. And, of course, you heard the tearful testimony by the president of Jefferson Parish when he was talking about the other official whose mother was in a nursing home right there in St. Bernard Parish. And calling every day, she was calling her son, begging him to come get her out of this nursing home. And on the sixth day, she drowned, died in this nursing home along with about 30 other patients. No one went to rescue her. She thought sure that they were going to rescue her, and her son thought so too. But there were no troops, no rescue people to take these people out of this living hell they were in. So this was just a total breakdown. Now, supposedly, the city of New Orleans, for the last 30 years at least, had worked out this elaborate rescue plan in case this devastating scenario ever should happen. Because they've always talked about what would happen if a Category 4 or 5 hurricane hit New Orleans directly. Well, everybody knew that the place would be underwater up to the second-story building. So they had worked out all these evacuation plans and supposedly had it all fine-tuned. And this is what happened. It was all a lot of boondoggle and lies. Now we learn that the reason it flooded was because of the rupture of the levees along the canals. And we found out that it was due to poor workmanship, poor design of the levees. And if you look at them from the helicopters, from the aerial views, you see just how thin these levees were. They were poorly designed, poorly constructed, because they stole the money that was allotted to build these things. So they just got the lowest bidder and threw up some concrete slabs and called it a levee. knowing that it was going to break if the hurricane ever hit of this magnitude, and of course that's exactly what happened. So, you know, what we see is just corruption piled on top of corruption for decades and decades, mayor after mayor responsible for it, city council, and then Nagin has the nerve after they evacuate the people from New Orleans. He can't wait to get them to come back. He wants them to come back and even says we're going to have a smaller Mardi Gras parade. And so the president of Orleans Parish, he was astounded. Now, he's just a city councilman. He said, I can't believe he said that. He said, there's no working toilets in the entire city. Where are these people going to go to the bathroom? There's no water that can be consumed in this city. There's no hospitals. There's no doctors. There's no nurses. All the hospitals are destroyed. Where are these people going to go for health care? And yet the mayor is telling them to hurry up and come back to the city. Why did he do that? Because he needs their money to continue to pay his salary. And so then he brings them back, and then here comes Hurricane Rita, and they tell him, you've got to get these people out of here. And he was incensed that George Bush called him and said, you know, you really need to get the people out of New Orleans. Well, I'm the mayor of New Orleans. Nobody tells me what to do. I'll take care of all the people in this city. And, of course, then he was forced to evacuate them. He almost created another disaster. The man should be arrested, removed from office, and another interim mayor appointed at this time. The man's dangerous. You know, he's guilty of manslaughter to the tune of almost 800 people that's been found dead in the city of New Orleans.
And there may be a lot more we don't know about.
That's right. I mean, they haven't examined all of these homes. You know, they just recently found two dead bodies in a house that had just totally decayed. It had been there for 3 weeks. They just discovered them. So they're still discovering bodies. They had all these nursing homes that had, you know, multiple dead bodies in them. Finding 45 dead bodies in the hospital. Charity Hospital had a floor filled with dead bodies. It's just, you know, it's unbelievable that the level of destruction of the hospitals and the infrastructure of New Orleans is just incredible, and it's contaminated. I don't know how you could ever clean this city up so that it would be safe. All of these chemicals, which are just hundreds of chemicals, are in this water. It's soaked into the ground, into the wood, to the infrastructure, to the foundation of buildings and houses. Every time it rains, these chemicals are going to be leached out of the soil. They're going to evaporate into clouds of toxic chemicals. They interviewed a toxicologist, and he said, there's so many chemicals here. I said, we have no idea what these combination of chemicals can do to people. And it's, the air is filled with it. He said that everybody should be wearing masks that are in this city. You know, to filter out as much of this as possible.
You know, that was so interesting. I saw these pictures, you know, on television and in the newspapers of these people wearing the white suits, you know, with a hood over them, and then wearing these sort of filter masks. And I'm wondering why are they doing that? These people are just sweeping the streets. Well, that explains why they're doing that. Certainly because of the toxicity of the air.
Oh, absolutely. All of the structures in New Orleans that were underwater are unfit for habitation, and that's huge areas of New Orleans and St. Bernard Parish.
Now, how about the Jefferson Parish? How did they spare?
Well, Jefferson Parish had about half of it, or maybe less, that was flooded to various degrees. Not near as bad as in New Orleans proper.
And, of course, Jefferson, is that a little higher-class neighborhood, or...?
Yeah, but it has a lot of middle class and lower middle class people. I mean, it's not a wealthy, all wealthy neighborhood.
But apparently they had law and order there. No, sir, didn't they?
Yeah, this is Sheriff Harry Lee's territory, and they don't put up with it.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment or two here at Radio Liberty. Our special guest this evening, Dr. Russell Blaylock. We're talking about the tragedy of New Orleans. We're talking about Katrina. We're talking about Hurricane Rita and what's going to happen there. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening, Dr. Russ Blaylock. We're talking about New Orleans and really the place is just uninhabitable and the chemicals that are there that have got into the ground. You pick up the story there, Russell.
Yeah, they even reported that a lot of people were storing outlawed pesticides and herbicides in their garages, such as chlordane. And these are highly carcinogenic. That's why they were outlawed. But it said, all this is dissolved into the waters. So we have literally tons and tons of highly carcinogenic and neurotoxic chemicals in this water. And, of course, it's soaked the entire city. And what's going to happen, I was reading in Forbes magazine that Halliburton is already establishing contracts to go into the city and do this massive rebuilding, and they just want to make it a showplace again. But they're building it on top of this toxic soup, this waste, this sewage. What you're going to see in New Orleans over the next 5 to 10 years is just multiple unexplained illnesses are going to crop up, epidemic disorders. And they say, oh, this mysterious disease is arising. People are having all these strange neurological symptoms or immunological symptoms, and these other people are developing high incidence of cancer, and we'll study it. And so it's going to be a cover-up after a cover-up, but there's going to be these multiple incidences of all these terrible unexplained diseases that's going to affect the nervous system and immunity and cause cancer. And these are the sort of things that we're going to see over the next 5 to 10 years.
Well, you know, the thing that disturbs me is that the federal government certainly was accused of being incompetent, and I think to sort of placate that and make the American people feel better about the incompetence of FEMA, as well as certainly the local authorities, because I think there's plenty of blame to go to every level of government, but they're going to spend $200 billion to rebuild that. Now, where in the world did they get the authorization under our constitutional system to take money from people, you know, in New York City and in California and in Oregon to rebuild this area down there? I mean, I feel very sorry for the people, and I believe that we should do everything individually we can possibly to help them, but to use American tax money to rebuild that area and then to give these corrupt corporations like Halliburton, and I don't know if they're still paying Vice President Cheney a deferred salary, but they certainly paid him a deferred salary for the first few years he was working, as Vice President. And you might think that some people would think that they were bribing him, and anybody who thinks that obviously has a suspicious mind, just because Halliburton gets all these no-bid contracts is excessively cheating, and it has been a number of times been found to, I mean, cheating the government out of millions and millions of dollars, and they punish them by giving them massive no-bid contracts to rebuild New Orleans. What madness is that?
Well, this is exactly what you're outlining here, is they've gotten several billion-dollar contracts to rebuild New Orleans. And, the whole concept that you talked about was passed before a constitutional lawyer, and he says it is an absolute violation of the Constitution to rebuild private property with federal tax dollars. Rebuilding your private property is between you and your insurance company or someone who wants to donate the money, but you have no right under the Constitution to ask the taxpayer to rebuild your home and build high rises and shopping centers. This is not within proper scope of constitutionality.
All right, hold that thought exactly there. Right. Hold that there for just a moment. We'll be right back. Well, Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Dr. Russell Blaylock, and we're just talking about the absurdity of the fact that the federal government is going to rebuild New Orleans and sort of make the people feel better about the total incompetence of FEMA and so many people from FEMA who were turning away the aid and they wouldn't let the boats come in from Florida to rescue the people off the rooftops, and they wouldn't let the boats come in to Louisiana. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of motorized boats could have come in and got the people off the roofs of the buildings so they didn't have to use the helicopters. It looks pretty dramatic on television when they have the crane come out from the helicopter and they boost the person up, but wouldn't it be a lot more logical to take them off in little boats? Well, they turned the boats away. I mean, I couldn't believe that. Did they ever let any of those boats in?
Eventually they did after this 6 or 7 day period. But I know of a case of one police officer came all the way from Florida with six or seven airboats. All the bought all his own fuel and said, you know, I have the airboats here to rescue people. Where do you want me to take them? FEMA impounded his airboats, and he never got them back.
That just goes to show you that no good deed will ever go unpunished by FEMA, that is.
That's right. And South Louisiana is Cajun territory. And this is a series of swamps, and these people live on the water. They all have airboats, POs, every kind of boat you can imagine. And usually when there's a hurricane or something, they volunteer all their boats and they go out and rescue people. And they did the same thing. They said, we'll be glad to go into New Orleans and rescue people. Wish they could have done thousands of people with all the boats they had. Well, they wouldn't let them in during these early stages. So these people were stranded on roofs, nothing to drink, nothing to eat, this boiling heat. Had small children, babies, pregnant women. I mean, it was just absolutely atrocious when you look at it.
But, of course, they could have rescued the people out of the hospitals. They could have rescued the people out of the nursing homes. They wouldn't have had 30 or 40 people die in one of the nursing homes, but the government was there to protect us, and they wouldn't let them in.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. I'll tell you, on the coast of Mississippi, where all these towns were totally destroyed, there's not even a trace they were there. My son went down to videotape. He's putting together a documentary on this tragedy, and he went down with his producer, and he was videotaping, interviewing people along the coast that underwent this destruction. And all of them's comment was the same: we don't like FEMA. They did bad, but the worst was the American Red Cross. They all hated the American Red Cross. Said they didn't do one thing for us. We couldn't get water. We couldn't get supplies. They were nowhere. And there's one in Pass Christian, which is a town near the Gulf Coast, completely destroyed. The entire town has disappeared. The people are living in tents and putting up tarps over the rubble that's left of their homes. So my son went down there to interview them. There's a very wealthy lady lives there. She filled a building filled with supplies. All donated by her, and she told the people in Pass Christian, come get what you need, no forms to fill out, I don't check anything, just take it. And she's taking care of the whole community by herself. Now, the Red Cross came in, went on to her land, they didn't know they were on her land, and she went over to them and said, what are y'all doing here? And said, well, we're here to help people. They were very arrogant. And she said, well, we don't really need you, I have all the material that these people need. And so they told her to get out of their facility or they were going to call the sheriff. And she said, well, I'll let you know you're on my land and this is a no bureaucratic zone and you get off. So she threw them out.
I heard that the Salvation Army was doing a pretty good job.
Salvation Army's doing a good job. Most all the church groups are just doing a tremendous job. They're bringing lots and lots of clothing and food and all the things that you don't really think about initially that people need, and ice and water and cooking utensils, mosquito repellent, supplies for babies, diapers, all of these things. The churches have just done a tremendous job. The volunteers have just poured into the Gulf Coast to help all of these people out. It's just been amazing.
Well, I talked to a friend, Colonel McKinney, Tom McKinney, and he, of course, he had his home there on the coast. It was totally wiped out, but he went down to make sure his family was all right. He was just saying how nice people were and how, you know, there'd be all the stoplights were out, so every crossroad was a four-way stop. But how everybody was respectful of everybody else. He saw only on one occasion where somebody, you know, was aggressive as far as getting across the intersection, but a real spirit of trying to help other people. Have you got that idea, at least as far as Mississippi is concerned?
Oh, yes. In fact, my in-laws live in Covington, which is in Louisiana. But she said that, all these trees fell in her yard and on her house, and they're elderly.
Oh, hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment. Whale. This is Dr. Stan back here. I guess this is Dr. Russell Blaylock. And we're talking about what happened in New Orleans, total chaos. What happened in Mississippi, where there was a real spirit of people helping people, black, white, all getting along together. Tremendous compassion, help coming from the churches, help coming from the Salvation Army, no help coming from the Red Cross, very arrogant when they did finally get there. And, you know, but this wonderful spirit of people helping people. You were telling us about, was that your mother-in-law? Or?
Right, my mother-in-law and father-in-law, they live in Covington, Louisiana, which is across Lake Pontchartrain. The town was just devastated, and they had seven or eight trees fell on their property, and one of them was on the house, and the tree had fallen across the drive. And she said that the neighbor came over right away with his chainsaw and cut the tree that was in the drive and moved it out of the way and said, oh, you need to be able to get into your drive. And so they contacted the local Baptist church, and they said, well, we'll come get the tree off of your house. And she thought they were just going to cut the tree off the house, that she got back, and they had cut all the trees up, moved them out to the street, and said, just clean her yard up, and said she couldn't believe it. Said everybody's helping everybody else, but it's just a heartwarming thing to see how people are helping each other.
Well, we got an awful lot of good people in America if we could just get the government off of our backs and let the local communities do what needed to be done. Of course, you have to have adequate leadership. Now, what about the National Guard? Did the National Guard get down there, you know, or is there at least some organized form of police and authority there?
Yeah, the National Guard has gotten high praise from all the people in New Orleans and in the Mississippi Gulf Coast. The National Guard has done a tremendous job. They bring in the water, they bring in the ice and food, and they've been very helpful. They help the local police department. So the National Guard are certainly heroes in this story and to be praised for what they've done. And, of course, these are local boys. These are guys from Mississippi and from Louisiana. So they have a strong spirit of their community. But they've done a commanding job. But all of these things like FEMA and Homeland Security, everything is 50 forms to fill out. Well, we'll have to see if we can get that. It's just red tape after red tape. In fact, even Trent Lott complained about it. He said FEMA came in and set up this supplies for water and MREs and said, well, you know, now tell the people to come get it. And he said, how are they going to come get it? They can't walk 10 or 15 miles. He said, there's people out in the woods and the farmland.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Blaylock was saying that Trent Lott, of course, Senator Trent Lott's home was there in Mississippi, and so, of course, by the time FEMA finally gets in there, and they set up a camp, and they get the MREs and water, and they just said to the people, now you can come and get it, and Trent Lott's saying, how are these people going to come and get it? I mean, a lot of them are 15, 20 miles away from here, and they don't have any transportation, they don't have any cars. How are they going to come and get it? And to pick up the story there, Russell.
Well, and he was incensed. He told him, he says, you have to go out and bring this stuff to the people. You can't just set up a stand and think people can make their way. So there's elderly people in wheelchairs, you know, there's crippled people, there's injured people. And all the roads are blocked because the roads were filled with all the debris from the destroyed houses. You know, he had a house 150 years old there in Pascagoula. It was totally destroyed. There's not a hint that it is there, just the rubble left in the ground. And he was incensed. You know, he really was furious at the actions of FEMA and these federal authorities. And he talked about, they had something like 50,000 or 60,000 mobile homes that FEMA had stored away in Alabama, I think it was. And they were just sitting on them. They said, well, why haven't these been delivered? Why aren't they here? People need homes. As far as I know, they haven't been released yet. But at least for the first 2 weeks after the disaster, all these mobile homes are still sitting in the FEMA base. They didn't even bring them to the people to have a place to live.
So, I mean, they make a lot of fuss about how we're here to help, but, you know, the only thing I've seen is I just got a fax from them today saying, if you want to donate, you know, why, you just call these numbers and you send the money to us and we'll make sure it goes to the right places. Now, what is FEMA doing at trying to collect money for charitable donations, you know?
I told you another way FEMA is wasting the money. Now, here in Jackson, Mississippi, we got some of the storm. It knocked down some trees and a lot of limbs. Nothing that we haven't seen with other storms that come through Jackson. FEMA has spent over $1.5 million in this area hiring people to pick up limbs, things that the city and the state can do without any difficulty. But here they've wasted over $1.5 million for picking up limbs in a community that didn't need any help. And then you have all these people down in the southern part of the state that have just been devastated. And they're not getting what they need. But it just shows how all this turns into a political boondoggle. The more they can spread out the money so everybody gets a little piece of money, then that's votes for whoever's in power at that time. But it's a process of buying votes, wasting money that does not need to be used in Jackson community and some of these other parts. Canton, which is north of here, they're picking up limbs and paying them to do it. $12, $18 an hour. Big contracts for the contracting companies to pick up limbs, which is something the city does. I mean, it's really absurd.
Well, because they're talking about spending $200 billion. And my understanding is that a lot of people are just moving in there. They're promising, you know, construction jobs, all sorts of jobs, as they're beginning to lay out their plans to rebuild this whole area that we're talking about. Now, they're going to let the casinos come on shore. Apparently, they've been on boats up until now. And now they're talking about even helping to rebuild the casinos to get the economy of Mississippi going again. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, we should have never allowed casinos in the state of Mississippi or any state ever. The casinos have done nothing but corrupt the politics of the state. They have destroyed the lives of hundreds of thousands of people. The number one people going to the casinos are the elderly. They're losing their homes. They're losing all their savings. Everything that they were going to pass on to their children, they've lost. I have a friend of mine whose parents lost $500,000 in the casinos. They have nothing now. We have billboard signs over there, all over the state, telling people, help with your gambling addiction, trying to help people who've lost their homes and can't stop gambling. This is all because we brought casinos in here. Now, supposedly they were going to use the money from the casinos or tax money from the casinos to build roads and pay teachers higher salaries and all of these educational things. We have not seen 1 cent for any of it. It has been a colossal lie. So the best thing this state could do is let the casinos destroy the rest of them. It's a blight on the state.
But it's certainly not the obligation of the federal government to help rebuild the casinos. That's the point that they're talking about. Oh, the federal government's got to come in and get those casinos built maybe up on land, and that's going to stimulate the economy. Well, it's just going to stimulate more corruption. But where, of course, once again, I ask the question, where does the federal government get the right to take money from you and me and people across this land to give it to people? It's a terrible tragedy what happened in Mississippi and in New Orleans. It may very well happen in Texas, but we have never established it was the function of the federal government to provide for people who chose to live in a place and the storm came and wiped out their home. Other people want to help? Fine. If the community wants to help? Fine. Even if the state wants to. But it is not the function to take money from people who live in Oklahoma or who live in New York City and send it to the political bosses down there, because you know very well that Halliburton and all the favored companies, Bechtel and Fluor, the ones who have been raping countries throughout the world, you know, the lesser developed countries who have been getting the big contracts to over there in Iraq, those very same corporations are getting no-bid contracts right there in Mississippi and New Orleans today. And where is the outcry from the politicians in Washington, D.C.? Why, they all get big big donations from those corporations. They're not going to speak out. And the only thing they're going to hear will be when the people of this country vote, go those scoundrels out of office from November.
Just to give you an example, you know, private donations could pay for most of the tragedy to the people. I've recently found out that Red Cross has taken in $800 million for this Katrina tragedy. He could pay every man, woman, and child affected by it $1 million apiece. So it shows how, you know, you have these massive contributions, charitable contributions that could take care of the personal tragedies, yet you have a federal government that says, oh, we need $200 billion or $300 billion, it keeps going up, in order to rebuild this. It's an absurdity. You look at the seawall, for instance, in Galveston, Texas, 17-foot concrete seawall. It's been there since 1908. It was built totally by the city of Galveston. They didn't need federal funds to build it. It's been there over 100 years, or almost 100 years. Yet here, suddenly, in order to build a levee in the state of Louisiana, we need federal dollars. We need to tax people in the state of California to do it. There's so much corruption and money waste in the state of Louisiana, you could build 10 levees 100 feet high around the city of New Orleans. All this is just predicated on lies and playing on people's feelings, because they look at all of these terrible tragedies, all the, you know, the poor people that's been, their lives have been destroyed. Well, my son's life has been destroyed, but I'm not asking the taxpayers to make my son a ward of the state and to provide him a job and look after him. You know, he can take care of himself, and he'll do it. So, you know, using the people's tragedy to justify unconstitutional acts, there's no justification for that.
And I think, I hate to say this, but I think the president is pandering to the American people, saying, I accept full responsibility for what happened. I accept full responsibility for what happened, so I'm going to spend $200 billion of your money, you know, to overcome the crisis that I created. In essence, is what he's saying, but nobody wants to say that because everybody feels so bad about what's happened, and it is a terrible, terrible human tragedy. I mean, certainly I can't ever remember a tragedy that parallels this here in the United States. You know, and now, of course, what's going to happen tomorrow and the next day as far as Texas, hopefully it won't be anywhere as near as bad, although there's probably going to be an awful lot of flooding there. And well, the other thing is you've got all these people evacuating, frightened to death, somewhere in 1.5 to 2 million people, trying to get out of town, bumper to bumper, not moving a few miles every hour, total chaos. Some of these people might be better in their own homes than they would be out in the road, you know, especially if those roads begin to flood.
Well, I can't believe in the state of Texas, supposedly they had all these wonderful plans that have worked out so meticulously, yet they didn't even have both of the lanes open in one direction. For instance, during our hurricane, I-55, which runs from the southern part of the state to the northern part, they closed off all the entrances and exits and made it double lanes. All four lanes had north. We took the entire population of New Orleans and South Mississippi with no difficulty at all. There was no sitting in line for 12 hours and burning up all these gas. But when you looked at what happened in Texas going out of Houston, they had 8 lanes of traffic, or at least it may have been as many as 4 lanes, and then the other 6 lanes were just sitting there going in the wrong direction. I mean, it was crazy. It was absolutely crazy. You're supposed to close off the highway and let all the traffic go in one direction. That way you don't have these sort of things happening. Well, it finally dawned on them after these people sat there for 12 hours, ran out of gas, and they said, oh, gee, we should have opened all the lanes in the same direction. So, I'd like to bring up one other point, and that's about New Orleans. People have to remember the tragedy in New Orleans was not caused by the hurricane. It was caused by the greed, corruption, and incompetence of the government of the state of Louisiana and of the mayors of New Orleans. Because if they had built the wall that was supposed to be built around New Orleans, the levees that would have been properly constructed, if they had had floodgates where they could have closed off the intercoastal waterways, none of this would have happened. But they didn't. And so it was the responsibility of the local governments and the state governments that was responsible for this tragedy in New Orleans. That means that the destruction of this city, the death of over 800 people, was the fault of government, not Hurricane Katrina.
And, you know, it's so interesting. What they do is they put so much information out and so much contradictory information, and I think a lot of that is specifically designed to confuse us. And, oh, it's the fault of the engineers. It's the fault of the federal government because they didn't put the money to repair the levees there. And if the federal government hadn't taken that money to repair the levees and used it for the war in Iraq, why, they could repair the levees. And yet it's the responsibility of the local community to look after itself, not to look to the federal government to repair its levees. And the people in the local government had to know what the problem was.
The state of Louisiana had the money to build the levees. They didn't need a nickel of federal money. You know, they said that you could have built a levee 100 feet high, a wall 100 feet high around New Orleans for $3 billion. If the state of Louisiana could have come up with that over the period of time necessary to construct it, you wouldn't have to have a 100-foot wall. You just have to have one 20 feet tall or 30 feet tall that it was a proper construction. But they stole the construction money, and all of these governors are now acting like they're heroes, and the city mayors, these are the people who stole the money, who said, we don't really need this money for these projects. It wasn't the Corps of Engineers. Corps of Engineers did all these studies and told them what they need. They didn't want to spend the money. They'd rather put the money in their pocket. There's a corruption in the city and the corruption in the state that was responsible for this, not the federal government. The federal government didn't have a responsibility to build this wall around New Orleans.
Well, I think that so often everybody wants to just point their finger at somebody else. If it was their fault, it certainly wasn't mine. And I think the beautiful example of that was the mayor. And he was given such an opportunity to get on 60 Minutes to condemn George Bush. Now, I'm no great George Bush supporter, and maybe George Bush might have done more, but this was not primarily the responsibility of the federal government. It was the responsibility of the mayor. And yet, they, 60 Minutes, let him go get off the hook, blaming other people for his failings. And, you know, and then, of course, the governor did exactly the same thing. Oh, it was the federal government's responsibility. The first line of defense for anything is the local community and then the state government. And the federal government should only be there, you know, as a last resort. And when it's going to come in, you can be sure that any problem that's facing the community will only get worse.
Well, it was interesting also that one of the attacks they're using, they're asking, say, well, do you think that Governor Haley Barbour of Mississippi was better taken care of by Republican George Bush over the governor of Louisiana, who's a Democrat, implying that, oh, Haley Barbour got special treatment? Haley Barbour took care of the state of Mississippi without any more federal involvement than the state of Louisiana had. Haley Barbour got his National Guardsmen down there immediately. He had the aide down there immediately. He went down personally himself to look after it. He organized it. He did it all himself. It wasn't because of his connection to George Bush. The mayor of Louisiana was told by George Bush before the hurricane ever hit, you need to evacuate this city. And he went ahead and ordered, declared a state of emergency before the hurricane hit. And, she said, well, you know, I don't think we need to do anything. And then when she nationalized guard, I mean, we had the guard activated, she said, well, you know, I just didn't know what to do with them. And even one time she's so confused, she said, gee, I don't even know what day it is. I mean, this is the governor of Louisiana getting on national TV and saying, gee, I don't even know what day it is.
And, of course, the idea that this was really a matter because George Bush didn't care about black people. Well, you know, I'd say, what about the mayor of New Orleans? Did he care about the black people there? He himself was black, had nothing to do with race. What they try to do is throw that in to just get, you know, people hating other people and pointing fingers.
Virtually the entire city council of New Orleans is black. The chief of police is black. Almost all the mayors, for at least the last five mayors, have been black. To say that this was a conspiracy against black people defies the evidence. I mean, it's sheer nonsense. If anything, there was betrayal of black people by black leaders, supposed black leaders.
But you know, Russell, it really doesn't matter how ridiculous something is. If you say it often enough, people are going to believe it. And they've used this thing over and over again. It's a conspiracy against the blacks on the part of the Bush administration. A Bush administration didn't care about them because they were Democrats, and so he wasn't going to give them any help at all. And I'm no George Bush fan, you know, if you listen to me, but, I mean, a lot of the criticism there has been totally unjustified. Until, of course, they sent in FEMA, and then, of course, that you couldn't justify. We're going to be back in just a moment to wrap up the program here with Dr. Russell Blaylock. Well, our guest this evening has been Dr. Russell Blaylock from Jackson, Mississippi, and his son lost his home there in New Orleans, and of course he knows that area very, very well. He's actually trained there. You actually trained there at the hospital there in New Orleans, didn't you?
Right. I went to medical school in New Orleans, LSU Medical School.
Well, you got about a 2.5 minutes to wrap up the program. What's the real message? What can we learn about, you know, from the tragedy that's befallen the people there and is in the process of unfolding over there in Texas now?
Well, people need to, number one, make their local government responsible. They need to elect people that are good, honest people who work for the constituency. They need to get over this idea that the federal government can take care of every problem that they have. You take care of your own problems. You take care of your own family. You don't depend on government at any level until you absolutely have to. But this entire tragedy was caused by a failure, at least in New Orleans, was caused by the failure of government.
And I really believe that. I think the one thing we have to remember is there's no problem facing America today that a new series of government programs won't make worse. So, you know, don't rely upon the government. I think that people have to begin making preparations. I hope you're never going to have to use any emergency supplies and things that you have in the way of perhaps the Berkey water filters and food supplies and the things that you'd want to use if you're going to have to stay in your home and the things that you'd want to take with you if you had to leave, and just hope you don't have to leave. You're far better off in your own home than trying to get out on the highways and not knowing what there's going to be to come back to. So, okay, fine. Well, Russell, if you have one parting thought for our listeners.
Yeah, let me say something else. This is a good example of what's going to happen if there's ever a major terrorist event in this country. We've heard all about Homeland Security, how well they have all this coordinated, and yet this is an example of what would happen if a nuclear reactor blew up or an atomic bomb blew up in the United States. Our government at all levels would be paralyzed. All this hullabaloo about, oh, we're prepared and we have the scenarios worked out, is just not true. You need to look after yourself. You need to get your supplies together so that you can take care of your family and your friends.
And I know I went to a civil defense meeting, and we were talking about what should be done, and somebody said, what's the Office of Homeland Security going to do? And one of the women put up her hand and said, we work for the Office of Homeland Security. Let me tell you, we don't have a program for you. If you're going to survive, if there really is a major disaster, you're going to have to be prepared on your own. And that was coming from somebody who was sent there by the Office of Homeland Security. Russell Blaylock, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. I appreciate it. God bless you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this is a little different than many of our programs, but I think it's an important program, and I think the message should be very clear. You're going to have to look after yourself. Now, our job is to advise you to make preparations. We carry a wonderful book called Inside the Red Zone, written by actually a Russian. He was trained in chemical and biological warfare as they were going to be waged against the United States, but the book carries a lot of information about, you know, making preparations. And the books such as that are very important. You can go up on the web and get down a list of the things you want to have put aside. And you should make preparations for yourself, for your family, and certainly, for your neighbors so that you can help others. But understand that in the final analysis, why you're going to have to rely on God as well. So our job is to do the best we can, but realize that there are forces out there that we're never going to be able to manage on our own. And of course, as trials come, we're going to have to become more reliant on our Lord. And you find if you really believe that the Lord is sovereign, and that, as Benjamin Franklin said at the Constitution Convention, the longer I live, the more convinced I become of this fact, that God rules in the affairs of men. And if a sparrow cannot fall without his knowledge, can a great empire be raised without his blessing? And I would ask that same question today, almost 250 years after Benjamin Franklin made that statement. We're going to have to rely on God. Benjamin Franklin, perhaps not a Christian, but he believed in the sovereignty of God. And I believe in the sovereignty of God, too. And we're going to have to rely upon him. We do the best we can, and realize in the final analysis, of course, we're going to have to increasingly rely on him. Well, this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that my ministry is primarily listener-supported. And if you believe, as I do, that we're involved in the spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, cultural, educational, financial battlefield, if you believe, as I do, that there really are the spiritual forces out there that are intent upon the destruction of our nation and bringing about a one-world government and a new world religion, if you believe, as I do, that there is another dimension there, and there are people who can contact that truly demonic dimension, talked about repeatedly in the Bible, and that many of the decisions that are being made now are in preparation for terrible times that lie ahead. We hope that many of you will decide you'd like to help us as we reach out across America on about 60 stations every week. But believe me, it's an expensive proposition. Remember, I'm an orthopedic surgeon. This is what I'm doing for my retirement instead of playing golf. I'm trying to stand on the wall and call the warning, as we're told in Ezekiel. We are to be the watchmen, we're to make the call, and if people don't listen to our warning, why, that's their problem. But if we don't make the call, then their blood is on our hands. So we're doing the best we can to let you know what lies ahead. And America has difficult times that lie ahead, because America has turned against God. So we ask you, of course, to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival. We ask you to pray for our leaders and for our ministers, but please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Our website, www.radioliberty.com, www.radioliberty.com. Our telephone number, if you'd like a free newsletter, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please do not call unless we ask for calls. Right now we have with us a Death Ridge, and we're going to be talking about the oil shortage, about what's going to be happening as far as the oil situation is concerned here in the United States. We hear a lot today about peak oil. We hear about Hubert's Peak, and if you go up on the Internet, you read about Dr. M. King Hubert, who actually prophesied back in 1956 that United States would oil production would peak in between 1965 and 1970, I think that was his prediction. And, of course, oil production in the United States did peak in 1971, as did natural gas production in the United States. Peaked in 1971, has been on the decline ever since then. Now we're told that oil production has peaked and we're on the downhill slide, and there are a number of people, even within the good conservative community, who are telling us world oil production has peaked. There's going to be a world shortage of oil. There are going to be conflicts to try to maintain the oil. Oil is a finite substance. We're running out of oil. And so we're going to explore this thought along with Ed Deathridge. Thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
Yes, sir.
Well, why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about your background, because I know you're interested in this basic subject.
Yes. Well, I have about 55 years or so of background in the oil industry, both domestic and foreign.
All right. Now, were you then in oil exploration or what?
No, it was. I'm a retired foreign service officer.
All right. Fine.
And I dealt with oil a lot in the Middle East and other countries like Mexico, from an economic standpoint, and also my family. See, when I was in junior high, my two uncles were the head of the field telling the companies Conoco and Phillips where to drill and how to lease and how and all that. And I learned a good bit from them during those days when visiting them and in Oklahoma, where they were stationed in Ponca City and Bartlesville, Oklahoma.
Well, now, of course, at one time, Oklahoma was a great producer of oil. Is it still producing a lot of oil down there?
Well, not as much now, but I think they've got a lot of a lot of capped wells and mapped wells that are not in production.
Now, why would they cap the wells, when there was still oil there to get out?
Well, one thing, my uncle, he retired, the one that was with the Phillips Petroleum and out of Bartlesville. He retired in the late 50s and formed his own company in four states with a friend of his, in the four southern states of Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana.
Well, could you speak up just a little bit louder?
In four states in Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama, and part of southern Arkansas. And he told me a lot then about it, that, at that point, until October of 73, when the OPEC put on the embargo and shot up the prices and all that, and gasoline, etc., we had an import quota.
And hold that thought right there for just a moment. We'll be right back in just a moment with Mr. Ed Deathridge. All right, Ed, well, go ahead, and you were telling us. You were saying that one of your uncles had told you about the import quotas that we had at that time. This was before the oil crisis in 1973. So pick up the story there.
Before October of 73.
But if the companies, the big companies, see, my uncle told me then that he was the price of oil was about $2.50 a barrel. Now you have three or four different prices, but there's not that much difference in them. You know, you got light sweet crude today, and you got West Texas crude and all that.
But at that time, the price of oil was $2.63 a barrel. That was pretty cheap.
$2.50 a barrel. This was 1959 or so.
I mean, was this 59 or was this before? 59 was that price.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he was making 100% profit. His cost was about $1.25 a barrel.
All right.
And but he told me that, and because I even talked to him about maybe going to work with him. And he told me, well, I could, but he said, if I wanted a full career, because he was retired and didn't know how much longer he would be with that company and all, but said if I really wanted a bigger career and all and better pay and all, that I should go with the what they call the Seven Sisters, the Aramco, Arabian American Oil Companies, that were with the OPEC, what became the OPEC. You know what I mean by the OPEC? That's an organization of petroleum exporting countries in the Middle East mainly. Said that their profit, they were making more than double the amount he was making because their cost was 35 to 50 cents a barrel. Now, that was landed in the United States. And today, the latest information I've had from good sources now, is that they're bringing a barrel of oil in here from Saudi Arabia, landed in the United States. Between $5 and $5.50 a barrel, depending on where it's landed, and they're selling it, you know, for in the mid-$60s to $70 a barrel. But what he told me back then was that those companies back then didn't know, back in the late '50s, they didn't know what the political situation might cause out in the Middle East and all, any time. So they wanted to know that they had oil in the United States, they had to use it. So they kept drilling and all.
Hold that thought right there. We're just going to bring our other stations back on board here. And our guest is Mr. Ed Deathrich. We're talking about the oil situation in America. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly Ed Deathrich. Ed, his family was involved in oil, and they told him a lot about the situation in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And of course, then oil was very, very cheap. You were talking about, you know, $2.50 a barrel that they were paying. They could sell it for, and some of them were making 100% or 50% profit. They could produce it for $1.25 and sell it for $2.50. But of course, they were concerned about what was going to happen over in the Middle East, and so it was a lot cheaper to get it over in the Middle East than to get it here in the United States. And so the idea was, well, what we were going to do, I think, was try to maintain our oil supplies here in the United States by capping a lot of the wells and not developing a lot of the fields, and get the oil out of the Middle East. Would that be a fair statement, Ed?
Yes. What they were doing, he gave an example that if they could get in a year, if they say get 5 or 10% increase in the consumption in the imports over the quota, then they would cap 5 to 10% more of the wells that they were drilling here and hitting.
Now, I think it's so important that our listeners understand that we have a lot of productive wells that were capped, and they were intentionally capped many years ago, so we would keep the supply of oil here. And why not use the Arab supply of oil? We could get it there dirt cheap, and so we'd keep the oil here in case of future emergency. And, of course, also there are going to be tremendous profits, especially if the price of oil went from $2.50 a barrel up to, $70 a barrel. Imagine the appreciation of the value of your holdings. So then Ed is saying that they begin capping our wells. They began, of course, certainly not developing oil fields here, and we then increasingly began to take the oil out of the Middle East. Why not use up their oil first? Would that be a fair statement?
Well, that was part of it, but also they just made a lot more profit.
Right.
And so you started originally with 13 countries in the OPEC, and now there's only 11, of those 13. And all of them except Venezuela and Indonesia were in the Middle East. Back then, you know, what you had, if you could hit one out of three wells, you were doing very good. And in the past decade or so, they can hit one out of one with the new technology that they have, which they call a 3D. And what they were doing then, when they had, when in 1973, that's when the OPEC became more open and all that, and that we removed the entire quotas, no more quotas on imports. So that's when it went on up, way up. Now, right now, in recent years and currently, we're importing about 60% of our oil consumption.
And we're consuming about 20 million barrels of oil a day, so
yes.
So we're actually then importing 60% of that from other countries, using up their oil, which we can, of course, get cheaper in many respects, because we don't have, you know, the expense, nowhere near as expensive drilling over there as it is here. It's much closer to the surface in many places.
Yeah, well, and particularly in Saudi Arabia, I've been there and out in all the fields, and they have it just a few feet.
Right.
In fact, they've got artesian wells and all. And I think they
artesian wells of oil coming out of the ground, right?
Yeah. It costs hardly anything to get it out of there, and the wages and all the cost for all their people working in the fields, you know, is much lower than here.
Well, of course, they've got a feudal kingdom. We're keeping the feudal kingdom, the ruthless, tyrannical kingdom, that puts women in second class, that chops off hands and feet and heads. But we never talk about that here in America. Oh, when we wanted, of course, to demonize the Taliban, we talked about how terrible it was they demonized women, why they chopped off heads and feet and hands, and, you know, but Saudi Arabia's been doing that for a long time. We don't talk about that here because we're keeping the feudal system going over there. But we can't let the American people understand. We're keeping a totally despotic government. We talk about democracy. We got to bring democracy to Iraq. We got the wicked Saddam Hussein. He doesn't believe in democracy. But we, of course, ignore the fact there's no democracy in Saudi Arabia, nor will there be as long as that ruling family is there. Would that be a fair statement, Ed?
Yes, I would say so, yes.
All right, fine. Well, let's get your thoughts on then. You're talking about how they capped oil production. They cut back oil production here in the United States so we could then bring it in from elsewhere. But we couldn't let the American people know. That's why oil production peaked in 1971 here, and natural gas production peaked because we shut off all the so much of the drilling and so much of the development.
Yes, yeah. See, of that 60%, probably half or a little more of it comes from the Middle East, the OPEC. We get a fair amount from Canada and Mexico. But the real problem is with the Middle East and all. Now, what the latest bill, see, the energy bill, finally, been working on it for many years. I've been working on it for 6 years, this October, next month. And in that bill, finally got one, which has some good things in it, but not enough.
You're talking about George Bush's energy bill, the Bush administration energy bill?
Yeah, the one that the Congress passed here just recently, and he signed it on August 8th of this year.
All right, fine. Well, how did you happen to be working on it? Why were you involved?
Well, I was trying to, since I've retired, I do some consulting with certain groups that are affected greatly by this, farm groups and, you know, family farmers and truckers and others, but those are two of the immediate ones.
And, of course, they're sick, you know, the high prices that's putting many of our truckers out of business. It's running up the cost of to the farm industry because they need it for the tractors. They need so many of the fertilizers have a petroleum base in them. So these groups are justifiably concerned about the artificially high prices of oil here in the United States. So that you were trying to get them to open up the drilling up there in the Arctic Wildlife Reserve?
Well, not in the what they call the ANWR, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. I don't think that would be that much of a problem. We could get a good bit of oil out of there. But you got more resistance from the environmentalists and some of those that live up there. There's differences. There's one group that's about 7,000 of people in a town near there. that are against the oil drilling. There's another one with about 9,000 in it that are for it. But and then you've got other environmentalists behind against that. But there's a lot of oil separate, completely separate, west of the Anwar.
All right. And whereabouts is that in relation to Prudhoe Bay?
Prudhoe Bay is part of it.
Okay.
And there's a lot of other there, and particularly Gull Island. That there was a book written about this in 1980 by the chaplain that was up there with the Alaska pipeline.
Lindsay Williams' book, The Energy Non-Crisis, right?
Yes. And with it, one that wrote that with him was one of the main officials with the Atlantic Richfield Corporation, ARCO. That was the main oil company at that time. And they have a lot of information about that, and Gull Island is one of the big ones. See, that the oil pipeline was built for 2 million barrels a day. 1 million, about 1 million to come from the Prudhoe Bay field, and the others, most of the other would come from the Gull Island, which is a few miles out in the oversea there from from the Prudhoe Bay.
But they've never developed the Gull Island reserves.
No, what they did, see, they started that in 1973, building that pipeline and the oil wells, and it took them about three years, a little more, to do it, about double the amount of time and double the amount of money that it should have, because some of the companies were against this, the pipeline deal. There were some of the big oil companies that were against it. But what happened, and when they finished this in early 1977, the federal government took over the Gull Island and capped it, and it's been capped ever since.
In other words, here's this massive oil reserve up there, according to Lindsay, and I've verified this with other people. Well, there's certainly as much oil there as in the largest oil fields over in Saudi Arabia, but they've never told anybody about it. It's been top secret, and they haven't developed that, and they want us to think we're running out of oil. That way, they can get the prices up. They can drive up the prices on almost everything. But why, at this time in our history, are they letting the price of oil go right through the roof?
Well, I don't know, but that's what's happening.
Okay.
The and you see, there were supposed to have been two pipelines built up there in Alaska of 2 million barrels a day each, and also one for natural gas.
Right.
But it was stopped. They only got the one. For a number of years now, that there's only been about 1 million barrels a day in that, because they took for a couple of years they took close to the 2 million barrels a day out of Prudhoe Bay. But they don't have that much now, of course. But it's been a number of years. There's only about 1 million in there. So at any time, they could. Wouldn't take long. Just a couple of months, probably, to get the oil out of the Gull Island and into that pipeline, 1 million barrels a day.
They don't want to do that because, I mean, if there was an abundance of oil, they couldn't get as much a profit as they're getting.
Well, that's part of the cause for it, a reason. That's right. But now, in addition to the information to confirm that there's a lot of oil up there, in the Christian Science Monitor, that's a well-known paper. I think a lot of people know that, and it gets in Congress all the time, in their offices all the time up there in Congress in Washington, D.C. On the front page of that, on April 26th of 2002, there was a statement quoting President Bush and the Department of Interior, that there was a lot of oil in Alaska, separate, west of and completely separate from the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and that they were going to start leasing or with federal lands, but hasn't been done. Now, there was also an article on January 18 of 2003 in the Kansas City Missouri Star. It was by the Associated Press. It's stating the same things about that, but there still hadn't been any leasing. Now, there's a lot of other federal land we've got in the lower 48 also that there is oil on, and it's not properly being leased.
And we're going to be back in just a moment here with our special guest this evening, Ed Deathridge. Well, Dr. Stan here, our guest is Ed Deathridge, and he's talking about the fact that there's a lot of oil up there in Alaska, And, of course, they could lease that out. They could start drilling on it, get the oil out, but they're not interested in doing that. There's a lot of other areas here in the United States that they could drill. They've still got those oil fields in Oklahoma and many other places that they could uncap, and yet they've capped these oil wells, and they capped them many years ago so that the oil production in America would peak in 1971, because they didn't want producing the oil here in the United States. So pick up the story there, Ed. When we got this new energy legislation through, it allowed at least some very limited drilling, did it? Or did it? What actually was in that legislation?
Well, there's some things for it, but the main problem, there's two main problems with that that's not in there in that legislation, and that I say anyway. And one of the main ones is that what I call a price support. Now, that's not a specific direct price support. It has to do with our taxes. See, we tax our oil consumption here, but there's no tax and there's no significant tariff on the imports. And that's from what they call themselves a cartel, which is a monopoly. It's against our antitrust laws. And we still let that happen.
And what you're really speaking of is OPEC, which is a cartel. Yes. It is a violation of our laws. But we've never done anything about it, and no efforts on the part of concerned citizens or groups to sue OPEC for being an illegal cartel. Nothing is ever done. In fact, our government consistently intervenes and prevents those lawsuits from ever being able to be carried out.
Yes.
That is, you have to ask yourself, why is it that our government is doing everything they can to protect the cartel that is driving up the price of oil? Unless, of course, there are very powerful forces in our government that want to drive the price of oil up to where it is today, and perhaps even much higher.
Yes. Well, now, so what happened, see, in 1998, the price of oil was around $20 a barrel. And it went up into the low and mid-30s. And several of our companies, like Conoco and Phillips and several others, Sinclair and Marathon and Diamond Shamrock and others, and Independence, went out to uncap and wells and drill some of the mapped wells and all. But within several months, OPEC brought the price down to $10 a barrel. They can still make good profit at that or not lose any money. In Saudi Arabia, they can still make almost about 100% profit on that. And the others could make some profit or wouldn't lose any money. They did that, only had to do it this for several months, because that really hurt the companies that went out. They had to spend a good bit of money and hire people, hire new people and train them, because they hadn't been drilling for, producing for a while, so they didn't have enough of the people to work on the field. And so when the price went down like that, why, that really hurt them, and so they had to stop it, and they didn't want to go out and drill like that again unless they know that couldn't happen. And when we couldn't get that done for the first 3 years, they're starting 6 years ago now, in 3 years, in 2002, the summer of 2002, companies like, for instance, Conoco and Phillips, well, they couldn't get it done, so they merged to be stronger and to go more foreign themselves.
Hold that thought there. We'll be back in just a moment with Ed Deathridge. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Ed was sort of explaining how this system works. He said that back in 1998, the price of oil was about $20 a barrel. It's being maintained illegally, of course, by the oil cartel, by OPEC, which has the full support of our government. In other words, they're operating illegally by national and international law. You're not supposed to be able to have a cartel that fixes a price. But that doesn't matter, because our government was helping them do it. Well, then, of course, here in the United States, with oil at $20 a barrel, some of our domestic corporations, like Conoco and some of the others, actually started uncapping all these wells that had been capped back, in the late 60s and early 1970s, and started drilling for oil. And as soon as that happened, and it was obvious that OPEC was not going to be able to dominate the oil situation, they dropped the price down to $10 a barrel, which made it unprofitable for these companies here in the United States to produce the oil, and they did that intentionally to put them out of business. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, that's in essence, that's it.
Yeah. All right, fine. So basically, of course, what you needed was something so that OPEC couldn't do this sort of thing. And yet, of course, OPEC has been fully supported by our government, and OPEC consists of some of the most tyrannical governments in the world at that time. Of course, Iraq was part of OPEC. Saudi Arabia was part of OPEC. Kuwait was part of OPEC. All of these tyrannical governments throughout the world were certainly part of OPEC, and they were being supported by our government. So pick up the story from there, Ed.
Yeah, you see, the OPEC, they meet every quarter at least, every 3 months at least, in Vienna, Austria, to determine their main purpose is to determine what price level they want, and then they're going to adjust their production to get that price level. Because they can have that kind of effect when they can affect so much of the oil that we consume. And so that sort of thing like that is a monopoly. That's open. I mean, there's no question about it. It's all openly. They admit it, and so does our government and all. But what we need to do now is the last 6 years that they're working on this energy bill, in each one of those, they've had what they called a price support. But it was only for marginal wells, what they call marginal wells. And they identified, said that marginal wells were only those that had a limit of 1,095 barrels production per year. The wells I'm talking about, some can do 1 million barrels a day.
Okay, and these are the ones that are available here and we're not developing?
That's correct.
Okay.
And that the effluent of the wells had to be 95% water. Well, that's when I first saw that. I thought that was a joke, but I checked it out, and it wasn't. And that's a water well. Now, see, out of all the wells, you usually get three items. You get some water, but that might only be about 5% or less. And then you get oil and some natural gas. Now, if you get more oil, you call it an oil well. If you get more gas, natural gas, you call it a gas well. But anybody can see in the fields. You ever go see where there's the pumps and all, and not too far away, you'll see big storage tanks that are pretty big around. And you'll see one that's not nearly as big around. And it's about the same height, not quite the same height and all. Well, that's the filtrator. And in the bottom of that filtrator, the water goes out. About halfway up, the oil is out, and it's in lines and piped over to the storage tanks. And at the top, the gas goes out. Because oil floats on water, and gas is lighter than oil. So that's the way it's filtered and all. And so...
And so what they were really saying was, we're not going to give any price supports to these wells that can put out 1 million gallons of oil a day, because we don't really want that here. Is that would be a fair statement?
Right, right. That's what I kept saying to the Congress, and some of them said, well, they didn't want to help the big oil companies. And I said... You know, they wanted to just help the small ones and the ones that weren't so good and independents and that sort of thing.
But, of course, what we really want is plenty of oil to bring the price of oil down, because the continued high price of oil is going to impact on every aspect of our society, whether it'll be the airlines, whether it'll be certainly Amtrak, whether it'll be the farming industry and the trucking industry, simply driving our cars, the fertilizer industry, the detergent industry, the paint industry, the plastic industry.
Sure.
Oil permeates every aspect of our lives.
Oh, yeah.
And for some reason or other, they're letting this price go right up, right out through the roof now, which is going to end up impoverishing the American people. And we have to ask yourself, why are they doing that? They know what's going to happen. It's going to plunge us into a recession like we haven't seen for a long period of time. Are they doing this intentionally? We're going to be back in just a moment with Mr. Ed Deathridge as we begin evaluating what's really happening to oil right here in the United States. Because believe me, there's plenty of oil. We're just not allowed to develop it. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and of course, when we talk about the amounts of oil, you have to understand that there are about 80 million barrels of oil that are consumed throughout the world every day, of which the United States consumes about 20 million barrels. The Europe consumes about 16.4 to 16.8 million barrels a day. China at the present time is consuming 5 million barrels a day, but constantly needs more oil because they have more and more cars. And certainly India is going through a great growth spurt. And so the remaining, certainly, 40 million barrels is consumed by all the rest of the world. But the United States, with about 5% of the world's population, consumes almost a quarter of the total oil that's consumed in the world. Now, you would think that we would want to have plenty of oil out there so we could keep the prices down, so it would not have an impact on our lifestyle. It would not begin to limit our access to energy. But what they're doing, they're driving up the price of electricity by every means possible. They're driving up the price of natural gas by insisting that all electricity be created from natural gas. Almost all of the new plants that are being built consume natural gas, which has then created an artificial shortage of natural gas, since we aren't allowed really to be developing that here in this country. So we drive up the price of natural gas, and it's natural gas is going to increase about 40% this winter all across the country. Heating oil is going to go up another 40% or maybe more than that. And people are going to have real problems. But as a byproduct of all of this, of course, they've blocked the development of nuclear energy. They've blocked the burning of oil, and they've driven the price of oil up so high it's very difficult to use it to create electricity, although we used that certainly in the past. They object to coal burning plants because they pollute the environment, and they're doing everything they can to drive up the price of electricity, to drive up the price of natural gas, to drive up the price of oil, and this is really going to have an impact on everyone in the listening audience. Would that be a fair statement, Ed?
Yes, that the essence of that is correct, yes.
Well, now, how many oil wells are there out there? You think we could get 1 million barrels of oil a day from here in the United States?
Oh, there's a lot of them. I think that within a year or so, if we would get this price support I'm talking about, of $23 to $25 a barrel. Now, several of these companies here can make a reasonable profit in the mid-20s per barrel. They can make 50% or more profit. And I think that's a pretty good profit margin for most companies.
Hold that thought right there. We're going to bring our stations back on board right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Ed Deathridge, and we're talking about really what's happening as far as oil. We're talking about, the oil wells are out there here in the United States that have been capped, Ed is saying that there are lots of oil wells that could make 1 million barrels of oil a day. And if they would get a price support of maybe $20, $25 a barrel, why, they'd have these things opened up. But rather than give a guaranteed price support on that, so that, if they did open them up and start to develop them, that OPEC couldn't drop the price again to $10 a barrel. Why, they're letting OPEC raise the price to, today, $70 a barrel. They were letting the monopoly operate, and of course we're going to impoverish the American people. Doesn't really make sense unless there's another agenda out there. So if you pick up the story, are a lot of the oil companies aware of this? And if this really is true, why are we told that all this oil is available here in the United States? We do not have a shortage of oil. All we need is a guaranteed floor so that they can start producing here at about, at least a third of what we're paying for oil at the present time.
Yes. I don't know that all of the wells can take 1 million barrels a day, but they can do a lot more than 1,095 barrels a year. My golly, they can. Most any well could do that much at minimum in a day.
Right.
And there's a lot in the lower 48 states that, some of the biggest ones, like up there, the 1 million barrels a day is up in Alaska. They're like the Gull Island and all.
Right. And, of course, the thing is that we've got a lot of oil and gas off our shores on both the East Coast and the West Coast, but they haven't been allowed to develop that. We can only develop the oil, of course, down in the Gulf.
Well, that's been the main thing. But one of the things that I've been going for a number of years is to not have, you know, they can do that, some of that, but we shouldn't be that dependent on it. We ought to have be more dependent on the oil inland, like up in Alaska and in about 10 or 12 states inland.
Sure.
Which wouldn't have nearly as much problem with weather like you do with a hurricane.
Right.
Now, they could have some down there and all that, but we shouldn't be that kind of dependent on it, and we shouldn't be dependent on so much imports in one port.
And, of course, the thing is that we have, what, about 30 or 40% of our oil production is down there in the Gulf where it's subject to the hurricanes. About what percentage of our oil company or oil production is coming from the Gulf now?
Well, it's about something close to that, yeah. The refineries, too, are heavily down there, you know, about a fourth or more of our refineries down there. Now, that's another problem is our refineries.
And, of course, they've blocked building of refineries here in this country for 20 years. I don't think we've built a new refinery for 20, 25 years. And, of course, they say it's environmentalist fault. It's all their fault. And they're being actually financed by many of our great corporations and foundations and by our government. The power of the environmentalists has never been their own power. It's been that of the media, of the government, the foundations, and the corporations that fund the environmental movement to block the development of things that need to be done. And you have to question why they would be, you know, why anybody would want to fund organizations that would block the development of gasoline refineries unless you're going to make an awful lot of money from the shortage of gasoline refineries.
Right. Well, now, see, the refineries, we have less than half of the number of refineries. We've about cut them more than in half in the past 30 years, I believe it is.
In other words, we had twice as many refineries 30 years ago?
Yes, about that, right. And the main reason for that is what several of the refineries companies have told me is that they've added, starting then, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, started causing them to have to add a couple of dozen of chemicals to it, like MTBE that you've heard more about, I think, methyl tertiary butyl ethylene. And that cost them so much to do it that they just didn't cutting out on the refineries.
But that was a federal piece of legislation backed by Bob Dole that you would either add ethanol or you would add MTBE. Now, Bob Dole got $150,000 donation to his private foundation from Archer Daniel Midland, which, of course, is one of the major manufacturers of ethanol. It has to do with corn. Certainly harvesting corn makes a lot of money out of it. Corn is used to make ethanol, and of course, Bob Dole was very well rewarded for that. You would think that somebody might have suggested the fact that he got that legislation through and then he got a nice donation for his private foundation. Somebody might have thought that was a conflict of interest, but I suppose maybe I'm just a little paranoid. But then the byproduct of that was you could also add MTBE, and that was going to purify the air. It was going to oxygenate the gasoline, make it burn better. But there wasn't one scientific study that showed that's what happened. And actually, what it showed is you actually got more air pollution. Not only that, but you could actually, this would seep right through the walls of the gas tanks and pollute the water level, and actually many major water wells were actually polluted by the MTBE. And then, of course, it really polluted the air more, and it was a carcinogen, but it was all a direct result of legislation passed by our Congress without ever one scientific study to show that MTBE helped in any way clean up air pollution. Why would they have done something like that?
Well, I'm not sure, but it just certainly shouldn't have been done. And now we have got one of the things that we did get done in this last energy bill is to remove that. The MTBE people, they've had some lawsuits against them. They've settled most of them out of court, but that's cost them a fair amount of money. So they've been trying to get in the energy bill that they would have protection from any lawsuits.
In other words, they couldn't be sued for contaminating the water supplies, wiped out some city, at least one city here in California. I mean, it destroyed the water. The people couldn't live there anymore because they couldn't drink the water.
That's right. But now they took that out. That was one of the things that the last 3 years or so that kept us from getting any energy bill.
Well, did they get that in this time?
No, it's sat there. They have no protection now. We got that out of the bill.
But I would think that the federal government ought to pick it up, and I think that the congressmen who voted for that legislation ought to pay it out of their pensions. After all, they were the ones who voted for it without any proof at all. It worked. Isn't Congress in any way responsible for the legislation they passed and the complications and the death and the cancers that they produced by their legislation?
Well, that's happened, but I don't know how much they knew about what it would cost or not, but I guess they did for some time now. But in any case, we got that removed, that condition. So, and also now in there that they've removed for at least a certain time that they don't have to put one of the other...
You mean the ethanol?
In there.
Okay.
Well, ethanol, no, there's other chemicals other than ethanol.
Okay.
The ethanol is not that big a problem. And now... What Congress was saying this past spring and all when they were debating the energy bill and discussing all that, the main points they were making now, this is all on record, we had to, prices of gasoline and other energy prices were getting too high, and we had to do something about it, get them reduced. And they said that the main thing then was that we had to get on alternatives, energy sources like the wind and solar and hydroelectric and on conservation, a better fuel mileage for cars, etc., and all that, and better insulation and all in houses and buildings and all that.
So you didn't need so much heat or air conditioning, is that right?
Yeah.
All right, well, how practical is it to have... Oh, go ahead.
Well, what they admitted, though, and it's all on record, that would take 7 to 20 years to get that done significantly. And so what do we do in the meantime? Also, very importantly, they were saying that we had to get off of the imports, dependence on imports, particularly from the Middle East, because, you know, the OPEC country, the main OPEC countries, because any time there could be some more explosions in the pipelines or more. And the one I'm most concerned about is the port of Hormuz, H-O-R-M-U-Z. That's the one there at the bottom of, in the southern end of Iraq and Iran. So all the oil, most of the oil from the Middle East comes through there and through the Persian Gulf.
And that the Straits of Hormuz, is that what they refer to?
The what?
The Straits of Hormuz?
No, it's the port.
It's a port, okay.
In the Persian Gulf.
Now, the Iranians have said if there's any sort of a confrontation over there, they'll block that port.
Oh, yeah, they could. If they had explosion there, that would really stop the oil from there. And what our economy, what our Congress said it and stated it, I heard it on the TV several times, by about a half a dozen of the senators and all, and it's all on record, that would, if you had not even that bad, but if you just had some of the other pipelines that were blown up, but we've had a few of those out there and had some problems, but it could be even more. What that would do is stop so much oil on the imports that it would put the price of our oil up to $90 to $100 a barrel and put this U.S. economy flat on its back. Now, I'm quoting them.
Well, I think they're absolutely right.
Yeah.
But everything they're doing is actually promoting this sort of thing because...
Well, what they said is the solutions were, the main one was the alternatives, but then admitting that would take 7 to 20 years. Now, the other thing they were saying was, well, we had to do more production offshore of Florida and on the West Coast.
Why don't we just open up all those oil wells in Oklahoma? We already got there.
That's what we should do.
But they're always talking about all the wrong things.
Well, that's right. I'm saying maybe they could do some of that offshore and all, but that shouldn't be. That should be a minor part. The main part should be inland, in Alaska and about a dozen other states. Now we've got a lot of oil, in fact, out in Montana and Wyoming. I have a cousin who retired years ago, but he was a roughneck for a number of years out in Montana and Wyoming in oil wells, and I started out that way and then got up a little higher. But he told me several years, about 4 or 5 years ago, that some of his friends that he'd worked with had spent, just not long before that, they'd spent a couple of years of doing nothing but capping wells in Montana and Wyoming.
Now, why were they capping the wells there when we need oil?
Well, that was the companies. That's what they were doing.
All right.
And so part of that was from the fact of what happened in 1998. See,
Of course, what companies were they? Do you know what companies?
Well, those were the domestic companies. I don't know what all the companies were, but it wasn't any of the Aramco, none of the OPEC.
What, was it any of the Seven Sisters were doing this?
No. They weren't the ones that were... Well, they did some of it, yes. They did some here, too, but there were other companies that weren't like... I don't know, I guess Marathon and Conoco and Phillips. I'm not sure exactly all that. I don't remember now all that, but a lot of them were not with the Seven Sisters, but some of them were.
So they're basically...
Now, the Seven Sisters are, that's Exxon and Mobil and Chevron and Texaco and BP, British Petroleum, and Shell, and Amoco, those seven. But they don't want to produce here in the United States when they can't make nearly the amount of profit that they can if they import it from the Middle East, particularly.
All right. Well, what do you honestly think about using solar energy? Do you think we can, develop enough solar energy economically enough to run this country simply with solar energy or with wind energy?
No, we can't. I mean, I'm for all of that, but that's going to take a number of years to do it. And what that would do, that isn't going to cut out the use of all oil. I mean, you can't run trucks and cars with solar or wind energy and all. I mean, and you can't, there are thousands of products that are made from petroleum, even women's lipstick, for God's sake, is made from it.
And this is what people don't understand. This is sort of pie in the sky. This is, it's sort of like, somebody's going to have a woman's going to have a baby. You get everybody boiling water. They're busy. It doesn't do any good, but, you're busy and you think you're doing something. And I tell you, we put a solar unit in our home, and, for the cost of that, and it'll take us 20 years to, get back, what we put into that.
Oh,
it's not a very practical means of yeah. cutting your electricity bill, I'll tell you.
No, well, it costs a lot, but also it's not that dependable. I mean, there's times when you have maybe a week or so when you have hardly any sun.
Right.
So what do you, and now they say, well, we can store that, but that would cost you a lot to do that.
And then you got
to
have banks of batteries, and the batteries run out. You got to keep putting water in them, and I'll tell you, it's an awful headache. If I'd known what it was like before we did it, I'm not sure we would have done it at all. Not only that, but they gave us a grant from the state to encourage us to do it, and they gave us this nice big check to help in the paper, maybe a quarter, a fifth of it, something like that. And then they charged us income tax on the money they'd given us to encourage us to go into solar. So I remember, beware of either an Arab or the government bearing gifts.
Oh, yeah. But so what I'm saying now, that what we've got to do is two main things. And I'm working with the Congress on a bill here, two bills now. To get this, what I call this price support, is one, but the other one, the first one that's already been introduced, is the title of that is the Windfall Profits Rebate Act of 2005. Now, the number for that is S, that means Senate, S-1631. And what that would do would provide consumers relief from high gasoline prices in the form of rebates funded by targeting windfall profits of major integrated oil companies. These companies have oil prices of them have gone from $40 to more than $70 a barrel in less than 18 months. Now I'm quoting some of this from the bill. And that's resulting in billions of dollars in what we call windfall profit. That means anything above $40 a barrel. And that's without significant corresponding increase in expenses for those companies. Now Senator Dorgan, who is the sponsor of this bill, Senator Dorgan from North Dakota, he says that this has, I'm quoting, drained billions of dollars from the nation's economy in a massive transfer of wealth from average Americans who can't afford it to big oil companies who already were experiencing all-time record profits.
But, of course, you can't pass an ex post facto tax on them, can you? In other words, you can't go back and tax them, for money that they've made before this new legislation was passed.
Well, no, this legislation wouldn't do it, though.
It would?
Yes.
You could go back then, and they've made the tax, they've made the profit, and now you're going to go back and take that money away from them that they've made?
Well, no, not all of it. He's saying they've made a lot of profit up at $40 a barrel, but anything above that, they'll have to pay it in this rebate check and get this back to the consumers through a three-year 50% excise tax on oil company windfall profits from oil sold above $40 a barrel. Now, oil companies reported all-time record profits at the $40 per barrel price level last year. ExxonMobil made that came out on the open, $28.3 billion for 2004. That was the highest profit ever made by any company anywhere in the world, in the history of the world.
Well, they're doing very well from creating artificial shortages. Because, of course, who's financing the environmental movement? Why, some of it's coming from the oil companies. And then, of course, the environmental movement blocks the building of refineries and blocks drilling. But you'll make a lot more money if you create artificial shortages. You can't do that on your own because that would be collusion and a cartel. So you get the environmental movement to do it. We'll be back here in just a moment to wrap up this program. Our guest has been Mr. Ed Deathridge. Fascinating information. Well, Ed, do you have a website or any sort of letter or anything that you put out there for people?
Well, this one now, this what I'm just reading you some from may be published as an article.
Well, I hope when you do, you're going to get that to me, because I'd like to our listeners abreast of this thing.
I can fax this to you and give you a fax.
All right, well, we'll get in touch with you, and because I would like to get you on my other programs. I'd like to all of our listeners across America. We do actually do four different programs every week to four different audiences. So we have a lot of people we're reaching, and we want them to understand how this whole system works.
Right. The one thing they can do, I want to make a point quickly here, that these windfall profit tax would be reduced dollar for dollar by investments that oil companies make in new domestic oil production, increased our new oil refinery capacity. So if they'll do that, spending it, then they can keep the money that would be rebated above $40 a barrel.
Well, I think that would
That would help production here and get the prices down for us and all the energy costs. Now, Durgan says, too, that I'm quoting him, the oil companies are reaping $7 billion a month in windfall profits, money that comes straight out of our economy and that most consumers cannot afford. So he's saying that would be part of the windfall profits they would do. Now, the other thing that we need to do is get this price support in there of $23 to $25 a barrel of oil and $3 per 1,000 cubic feet of natural gas. Now, natural gas is over $12, so that is more than four times what it should be, and that's one of the big things that's hurting the farmers with their fertilizer and their insecticides and all that.
So what you want to do is get a price support for oil and gasoline far below where it is today, and that'll get the production going, and we wouldn't even have a problem then.
Yeah, and that would prevent the OPEC. You see, we probably wouldn't even have to use that price support because OPEC would know that they try to bring it down to a little below that, it won't do it. We'll have it for that, so they can make it, so they won't be able to do what they did in 1998. We didn't have any kind of price support like this. So if we can get this thing, and I'm working on that, trying to get it in legislation here within the next month or less, get it passed, and then get his bill passed, and then get this price support too within the next month or so. And if we can do that, it would greatly increase our oil and gas production in 2 months of starting it, like especially from Alaska's the Long Cap Gull Island well, and reduce our imports from 60 to 20% or so, and most of that oil would come from Mexico. And maybe some from Canada, but no imports from the Mideast and Iraq, Mideast OPEC monopoly.
We're out of time, but
they would be then able to export more of their oils to China, Japan, India, etc., and help the world economy, and that still would make them reasonable profits.
Hey, we're out of time, but God bless. It sounds like a great idea, an idea that time has come. Thanks so much for being with us, Ed.
All right. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, Dr. Stan back here, you know, and I learned so much from talking to our guests. Now, Mr. Deathridge said this legislation's got a couple of great things in it. First of all, the oil companies would have to pay a windfall profit tax unless they would invest the money in new refineries or in putting oil wells in this country, which of course they would because they wouldn't want to pay the money out in taxes, and this would bring the prices down. The other thing would be to put a price of $3 for a million cubic feet for gas and certainly $24, $25 a barrel for oil. And the prices would certainly come down and come down dramatically, and they'd probably come down all that way. And this is one of the few places I think that you could use federal legislation, because the federal government has been blocking efforts to sue OPEC for what it's doing. Has been protecting the Seven Sisters, been protecting OPEC, and the only way we're going to get anything done is to get the Senate to use its power. I would like to get the government completely out of everything, but you're not going to be able to get that. You're going to have to do what's possible at the present time, and I think that perhaps this is an idea that's time has come. Ed is working with the Senate, and they hope to get this legislation through. The price floor, in other words, a support price for oil and natural gas, very low, but of course it would then encourage the development, and then of course the windfall profit tax, with a proviso that they wouldn't have to pay the windfall profit tax if they would invest it here in the United States. Great ideas, and I think that deserving of our support. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is the time when I have to remind our listening audience that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And if you believe in what we're doing, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And help us as we reach out across America 5 hours every weekday and then on our weekend program. And we, of course, are on shortwave, we're on radio, we're on the Internet, we're on satellite. And you can listen to our programs 5 hours a day, not get a thing accomplished. Talk to a fellow today who told me that he watched, listened most of the 5 hours a day to our programs, then he watched television. His wife would come in and say, "What did you get accomplished today?" And he'd say, "Nothing." But of course, he's certainly one of our good supporters, and he's also, you know, he accomplishes a great deal when he is working. But the information is there. We want you to get it. And we'll be putting together 4 tape sets on the phony oil crisis. And it is a phony oil crisis, and 4 tape sets on so many of the subjects it faces today. And we hope many of you will want to get the information and help to get it out across America. If you'd like a free copy of one of our newsletters, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Ask for a free newsletter. And if you'd like, go to our website at www.radioliberty.com. You can listen to our live programs there. You can pull down our newsletters and copy them and distribute them. And anything we've produced in the way of videos or audio tapes, you have our permission, as long as you're not making a profit, to copy it and get the information out. Our job is to inform the American people that we're involved in a spiritual battle being played out on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. There really is another dimension. There really are evil people who worship Lucifer. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.